Thank you, Phil, and thank you to everyone. Just as a touch, when I look around at the audience, some of you might not know who this is. This scumbag ruined the lives of so many workers. He ruined the lives of so many Indigenous people, you know, anybody really who he didn't like, and I'll get into the sorts of people he didn't like, but pretty much anyone but his, you know, scummy rich mates who were, you know, investors and miners, mining company owners and all the rest of them. So that was him. So it's a bit of a, this is him now. It looks worse than this now, and I have to say, it's one of my favourite photos of him. But as a bit of a timeline cleanse, let me put this here. And for those of you who don't know, this is the Tower Mill Observatory. Look and share it. Those of you who don't know the significance of how that's significant to this talk, you'll find out. So I'm glad you're here. You'll get to know. So Bjelke Petersen was labelled the hillbilly dictator by journalist Evan Witten, after a retired judge called him the hillbilly juror. Bjelke Petersen became premier on August the 7th, 1968, when the premier, the incumbent premier, died. He was pushed out in 1987 as the stench emerging from the Fitzgerald inquiry into police and government corruption couldn't be ignored. He was a populist politician. He believed in free enterprise, self-help, the monarchy, anti-communism, social conformity, and common country values. Pumpkin scones and all the rest of it. His government is characterized by smashing democratic principles to privilege a select and powerful minority. The Bjelke Petersen government in power was authoritarian and repressive. He continued and reworked Labor's gerrymander, and the gerrymander is where effectively country votes were worth double those of city votes. And this ensured that his government never lost an election. His authoritarianism did not arise from nowhere. He was preceded by a number of Labor governments that weren't progressive. They laid the basis for his repression. In other words, the gerrymander as well. So they've countered the argument that conservative governments are the only creators of repressive measures. I want people to take away from this talk two important political points. The first is resistance that escalated and challenged his increasingly authoritarian government continued despite the repression, despite the severe consequences of resisting his government. You know, people were jailed, beaten, and had their lives generally ruined. Now, although it was a bureaucratic mechanism, in other words, the Fitzgerald inquiry, which forced him out of power, there's no doubt that the resistance forced him to compromise and on occasion back down. The resistance warned that people wouldn't tolerate repression and attacks on their rights without fighting. The resistance helped to build the left and in turn was largely led by the left. The second point is that even though the current Palaszczuk government might not seem particularly authoritarian and repressive, particularly compared to Bjelke Petersen's government, we can't rest. The growth of the far right in many countries is a feature of capitalism now, and to wait until our rights are trashed is far too late. We need to fight constantly to achieve and to hold on to our rights. But importantly, we need to build the left with an orientation to fighting and a left based on clear revolutionary politics. So I just want to give you a little bit of a sense of what it was like pre-Bjelke Petersen. From the mid-1960s, the centre of radical action was this campus, this university. In August 1964, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations started when 20 UQ students confronted 50 cops in Anzac Square. In the ensuing scuffle, the cops pushed those students into a group of women who were protesting the French nuclear tests. When the Vietnam protesters were joined by anti-war workers, the anti-Vietnam War protests escalated. In March 1966, they organised peace concerts, teach-ins on the campus, and at one stage, a week of protests on the campus. At a protest outside the US Embassy, members of the Youth Campaign Against Conscription burnt draft cards in the middle of a busy city street during peak hour traffic. There were random arrests, and the police brutality that ensued made national headlines. And this is the kind of, you know, motive throughout the occupation regime. In 1967, the Vietnam Action Committee organized protests against the visits of US President Lyndon Johnson and South Vietnam's Vice Marshal Khai. At the anti-war protests, the cops used the Traffic Act as the basis for making the arrests. And they also used the Traffic Act to deny permits for marches, and I'll discuss that in a moment. So the students ramped up their activism and agitation on campus against the Act. They held and organised mass fora debating civil liberties, military conscription, and global capitalism. In protesting the Traffic Act, the Students for Democratic Action at UQ organised a forum on the 8th of September 1967. 5,000 staff and students attended and voted to march illegally. Now, just bear in mind, the entire student population at that time was about 8,000. So 5,000 is a decent turnout. Students for Democratic Action led 4,000 staff and students on this illegal march, and they marched on the road from here to the city, protesting Australia's involvement in the Vietnam War. The cops moved onto them to arrest them, but about 1,500 students sat down and refused. The police predictably responded with violence and arrests. So what we saw with the state continuing to ramp up its repression and its intransigence towards, allowing permits for marches and things, the whole street march issue expanded into one of Queensland's major ongoing campaigns, and I'll talk about that in a moment. So the continued state repression from Bjelke Petersen and his government and the growth in the far left groups led to the formation of groups mostly based on campus, such as the Students for Democratic Action, the Vietnam Action Campaign, the Young Socialist League, which is kind of loosely the Communist Party affiliated, and the Revolutionary Socialist Student Alliance. That's a bit of a taste of what it was like before Joe. Lots of activism, lots of reason. Okay, so now we get to what life was like under Joe Bjelke Petersen. In Brisbane in the 1970s, it was almost impossible for any band of musicians to get a gig anywhere. That's not just because there were very few live venues, but because Bjelke Petersen had introduced repressive laws that saw gatherings of young people as though they were violent protests requiring brutal police action. In other words, just going to see your favourite band was likely to get you beaten up or arrested or anything like that. In 1962, the Queen's Birthday Ball, which I'm not sure exists anymore, but it was a major event in the LGBTIQ calendar, started in Brisbane, and it continued under Bjelke Petersen. Now, homosexuality was a crime in Queensland at this point, until the 90s. So this very brave group of people used to rent holiday homes. They and their friends would rent, somewhere to stay on Mount Tambourine, and so they'd be able to party away from the Queensland police. And this event grew to such an extent that it became the longest running continuing LGBTIQ event in the world. The media at the time under Bjelke Petersen was co-opted, the parliamentary due process was severely eroded, and the police and judiciary operated according to the government's demands. Queensland historian Raymond Evans says, freedom of expression was sacrificed to oppressive censorship, minority rights were a risible intrusion, and civil liberties the dangerous ploy of extremists. Bjelke Petersen wanted Queensland to break away from the communists federally. This is a Whitlam government. He relied on crude red bashing, whipping up fear of Canberra, anyone from the south, students, blacks, gays, and the Labor Party. Queensland at the time was a low-tax, low-wage state to encourage investment. But public spending was the lowest nationally. Only sport and tourism-related services benefited from any public investment. His focus was to foster economic growth as a goal in itself for the narrow sectional interests and outcomes of a privileged few. And he would neither tolerate Indigenous people nor concern for the environment as obstacles for his focus. He refused to cooperate with the Commonwealth's new powers of Aboriginal administration put in place after the 1967 referendum. Instead, he introduced in 1971, the Aborigines Act of Queensland, which contravened 15 articles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Indeed, a shame. A visiting white liberal politician from South Africa, and at this time South Africa had its own apartheid regime, which was absolutely murderous and brutal. This liberal white politician was shocked at the living conditions of Aboriginal people in Queensland. While on the other hand, Bjelke Petersen described Queensland's Indigenous people as wealthy as Arab oil sheikhs. Yes, indeed. Other actions, just to give you a bit of a sense, other actions Bjelke Petersen took included in 1977, he arbitrarily suppressed progressive educational programs and vetoed sex education in schools. Like Queensland kids were not allowed to know about sex. In 1984, he introduced legislation outlawing pickets by striking workers. And then in 1985, sacked 1,000 striking electrical workers, SECWEB workers. SECWEB was state owned at the time and put in private contracting. In 1985, he also ordered a raid on a Brisbane abortion clinic after his government's Unborn Child Protection Bill was withdrawn in 1980 after enormous public protest. So despite the wholesome family values image and veneer of Christian respectability he promoted to justify censorship and repression and outlawing of gambling and prostitution, graft, secrecy combined and flourished because of the repression. It is estimated senior police received hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes from protection from illegal gambling, casino operators, and brothel owners. A quote from the late activist Sam Watson gives an idea of what Bjelke Petersen hated most. Before being beaten by a cop, the cop said to Sam, "Son, I'm going to give you a flogging for three reasons. One, you've got long hair, so you've got to be a hooker. Number two, you're a uni student, so you've got to be an agitator and a radical. And three, you're probably a black communist." That kind of gives you a sense of what he didn't like. And the cops. Various explanations existed at the time as to why Bjelke Petersen took such a hardline stand against street marches, such as Queenslanders are different, Bjelke Petersen is some kind of lunatic, or the gerrymander made him so invulnerable that he didn't really care what the public thought of him. None of these explanations are really adequate, and they're certainly not ones that you could mobilise a campaign around. On the other hand, the international socialists, who are a forerunner of our organisation, this organisation, Socialist Alternative, argued at the time that Bjelke Petersen was attempting to play a vanguard role for the Australian ruling class. And although his attack was initially aimed at the anti-uranium movement and the left, he intended to broaden it to begin attacking the union, to take on the union. The international socialists argued he was suited to this role because of his support base. In other words, farmers and the mining industry. And mining companies, because mining is a very capital intensive production method, that has very intensive production methods, it employs fewer workers than a number of other industries and also rakes in huge amounts of profits. They were very confident, the mining industry is very confident that it could wait out any strikes that might result from Bjelke Petersen's attacks on the unions. But in striving to divide the community, Bjelke Petersen instead helped to create a common enemy. He radicalised and politicised a section of the population. And far from getting it all his own way, he was beaten back over important issues. And I'll get on to the resistance now. So as with the nature of dialectics, so from the authoritarianism, the discrimination, harassment and marginalisation of the Jogians, emerged the resistance from a wide section of the community. Subcultures emerged and subverted censorship and moral surveillance. For example, on this campus, a radical radio station, 4ZZZ, started in December 75. We saw music, theatre and art all merging with activism. The parliamentary opposition, the Labour Party, committed as it is to running capitalism, was conservative. Its base at the time was small farmers and small business owners. It sometimes took a more right-wing position than Bjelke Petersen himself. Just to give you an example of some of the crimes of the Labour Party. In 1976, the ALP Vice President, Jack Edgerton, attacked railway unionists for striking because they didn't want to handle uranium. Exactly. In 1978, Ed Casey, who was leader at that time, for the later 78, attacked striking electrical workers. Also in 78, Tom Burns, who was the leader before Casey, initially opposed the ban on street marches. And even when a march did get a permit, he didn't want to be in the marches in case there were militants on the march, for heaven's sake. So in effect, the most effective resistance came from a range of outside bodies, student groups, academics, conservation groups, churches, Aboriginal rights organisations, civil libertarians, trade unionists and feminists. But overall, it was the radical left who built and organised the most militant actions. Not to downplay the importance of the campaigns which contributed to the atmosphere of resistance, I want to highlight a couple of them where the impact was significant or which achieved significant gains. And this is where the Tower Mill comes into its own. There's a protest outside the Tower Mill. This was the Springbok Tour of 1971. Springboks are the South African rugby team, national rugby team, all white at the time. And we know that South Africa wasn't an all-white country. It was a national tour that they were taking, and it was a national campaign, and it was built to protest them wherever they played. In Queensland, the resistance included the UQ student left, the radical left, unionists, anti-racist protesters, and church groups. Now, in preparation for the arrival of the Springboks, Bjelke Petersen declared a month-long state of emergency. But this was the eighth state of emergency that he'd called since 1968 when he became Premier. He called the state of emergency a week before the Springboks arrived in Brisbane. And essentially, it was to stop the anti-apartheid protests and the protesters. And so that the match could go ahead, it was scheduled to be played at the showgrounds, the RNA showgrounds. The state of emergency gave the cops extremely wide powers, very extreme measures to control the protests, and you could imagine they used them willingly. But the resistance occurred from the outset. So when the body overseeing who ran the showgrounds pulled out from supporting the game, because of fear of protests, the game was switched to Ballymore Oval. Now, some plumbers had to put in and upgrade the toilets at the Oval. And Aboriginal elder Bob Anderson, who was then an organiser for the Building Workers Industrial Union, was sent out to oversee the plumbers' work. And he recalls how he talked to them about the campaign against the Springbok Tour, and it resulted in the plumbers walking off the job in solidarity, saying, "Let them piss on the green." Now, students and the student left played a significant role in this campaign. On July the 21st, so the day before the Springboks arrived, in response to the tour and in opposition to the state of emergency, the student left organised about 2,000 students to march from UQ to Roma Street Forum, and then onto Parliament House. Now, the police were there to welcome them, arrested quite a few, and used excessive force. So the next day, the Springboks have arrived in Brisbane, and they'd already been to other states, and they'd already been met by, you know, protests and all the rest of it, and those protesters had been, you know, beaten by cops. In Queensland, they organised protests day and night outside the Tower Mill, which across from the Tower Mill was the Tower Mill Hotel, and that's where the Springboks were staying. They also organised protests outside where the matches were to be played. So on the day that the Springboks arrived, about 300 protesters and about the same number of cops gathered outside the Tower Mill Hotel on Wickham Terrace. After a few hours, when things went on, you know, just both sides kind of eyeing each other off and whatever else, the cops attacked, chasing people down the hill and kicking those who had fallen over. So it's a fairly steep hill, people were chased. You know, people took cover in the Trade and Labour Council building and all kinds of things trying to get away. The protests continued outside the Tower Mill the next day and were once again met with police brutality, resulting in more arrests and injuries. And the late activist Sam Watson highlights the determination of the protesters, commenting, "When we were at the Tower Mill in July and a cop was cut loose on us, you took your lumps. Then you got patched up and you backed up again the next night to the Tower Mill again." 40 unions also protested the state of emergency and boycotted activities related to the tour, such as they refused to service the planes transporting the players, the rugby team. They wouldn't serve them alcohol in their hotels where they were staying. They refused to transport police horses to the protests, and they halted the mass production of police batons. Six rugby players also refused to play and instead joined the protest. Yeah. I know. The protest succeeded in raising awareness of apartheid and led to the cancellation of the upcoming South African cricket tour. When Donald Bradman, who is a very famous cricketer and by no means a radical, declared, "We will not play in South Africa until they choose a team on a non-racial basis." So this exposed nationally and to the world that the protests and the police actions exposed nationally and to the world the brutality of the Elke Peterson regime. And just to give you a sense, I mean, you know, you can see sort of the crowd there and the protests themselves. I'd like to show a little video if I can, actually. It's a very, very short one, but just gives people a sense of what it was like at the time. So I want to talk about the role of students now. So the students, in response to the state of emergency and the racist tour, ramped up their anti-racist activity. And on July 23rd, so the day after the Springboks arrived, UQ students held a mass meeting that was attended by about 3,000 students. And the meeting voted for the first university strike against racism and the first political strike at an Australian university. Exactly. They occupied the Union Building and turned it into a centre of anti-racist activity. The strike started by students refusing to attend lectures. It spread to staff and it disrupted classroom. They leafleted and picketed. Supportive staff scheduled anti-racism seminars with invitations to Indigenous speakers. A number of departments supported the strikes, with several establishing plans to address the issues we're facing Indigenous communities, and universities and other cities gave their support. As the strike continued, classrooms were picketed and on-strike signs were posted throughout the university. On the 26th of July, 5,000 people attended a meeting in the Great Court, and a majority voted to declare they would strike for the duration of the Springboks tour, and that this university is a centre for the discussion of and action against racism. So the anti-Iranian movement. Oh, what's happened there? There we go. On the 23rd of June, that's an anti-Vietnam moratorium in what's now Queen Street Mall. That was Queen Street at the time. So you can see it's chockers. Hat. On the 23rd of June 1976 in Townsville, the world's first anti-uranium strike occurred by the Australian Railways Union. They called a 24-hour national strike over the Railway Department's refusal to reinstate a railway worker who refused to handle a uranium shipment. The national anti-nuclear movement emerged after Malcolm Fraser, the Prime Minister of the time, Liberal, in 1977 that Australia would begin uranium mining. The anti-uranium campaign opposed nuclear proliferation, US bases, and French atomic testing in the Pacific. As the Queensland anti-uranium forces began to mobilise in response to Fraser's announcement, Bjelke Petersen declared on the 3rd of September 1977 that political marches were a thing of the past. He declared, "The day of the street march is over. You can apply for a permit if you want one, but you won't get one." In response, on the 22nd of September 1977, several hundred protesters, mostly students, voted to march from King George Square to Parliament House. They were blocked from leaving King George Square by rings of police around the square. Imagine, you know how big King George Square is. You can imagine how many cops there were. So they sat down and they linked arms, chanting, "Queensland is a police state, demand the right to demonstrate." And we still chant that now in the case. A month later, in October, about 3,500 anti-Iranian protesters voted to march. Over 400 were arrested. The cops told one activist in the watch house, Sandra Bloodworth, who's a leading member of our organisation, Socialist Alternative, that she wasn't allowed to make a phone call to ask someone to collect her children from school, saying, "If you're at home where you belong, you would not receive one." Indeed. And then over here now, this is an inquiry about domestic violence. The arrest of 400 protesters was the largest civil disobedience arrest in Australian history. The anti-Iranian campaign gained national significance, and at subsequent demonstrations, the cops continued with mass arrests. Under intense pressure from protesters and unions such as the Miners' Union, the Waterside Workers' Federation, and the Seamen's Union, permits were granted for an anti-nuclear protest in August 1979, the first one in 2 years. So the campaign had won the battle, forcing Bjelke Petersen to back down. But left-wing activists did not rest and take a break. They geared up for the next big fight, which was spurred on by the attacks on civil liberties emerging in response to the anti-uranium campaign. And this is the Right to March protest, or the Civil Liberties campaign. This was about 1977 to 1979. Now, Bjelke Petersen's ban on marches was not total. You could have Anzac Day marches, you could have Australia Day marches, and you could have, thankfully, the non-existent Warana Parade as well. Exactly. But you could also hold Labor Day marches, and that's because the union is so strong you wouldn't take them on. But any other marches needed a permit. And of course, the cops, which functioned as Bjelke Petersen's private army, refused any requests for a permit. The Right to March campaign kicked off in response to Bjelke Petersen's ban on anti-Iranian marches. The campaign was based in Brisbane, but it reflected a statewide movement which involved thousands of people and led to violent clashes between police and protesters. At the biggest march in December 1978, 346 people were arrested and then packed like sardines into cells and were denied legal access more often than not. Now, within this campaign, anyone who's been involved in a campaign group, you kind of know the different dynamics of the different groups involved and who people representing different groups and whatnot. The main argument in the campaign was whether to defy the ban and to march. Now, there were groups opposed to the illegal marches, including some on the left, including the Communist Party and the Socialist Workers' Party, who argued that militant actions such as marching would alienate the middle ground. It's all our liberals. Thankfully, those like the International Socialists who were pushing for illegal marches won the argument. The ALP and the union officials had to be dragged kicking and screaming to support the protests. Mm. They were worried by the numbers of workers involved in the campaign and the protests, and with workers complaining that their officials were nowhere to be seen. So some Trades and Labour Council officials appeared at the head of the illegal marches and got themselves arrested. But essentially, the Labour Party tried to distance itself and the union movement from the Civil Liberties campaign in order to destroy it. At a union rally for civil liberties in December 1978, the leader at the time, Ed Casey, argued that change to the law on street marches should be brought about through the ballot box, not on the streets, he told protesters. And like they do, we still have. He said, we cannot become government in Queensland on the streets. We must take this emotional question away from the violence on the streets into calm common sense, consultation and conciliation. The Socialists left of the ALP formed in 1978, and it grew very quickly around Senator George Georges, who in the beginning was a very important part of the Civil Liberties campaign. But very quickly, the ALP machine soon attacked him and took disciplinary action against him for criticising the leader. The Civil Liberties campaign did not end the Bjelke-Petersen government, but it did force him to back down. And in 1979, as I mentioned earlier, permits were granted for an anti-Iranian march. Now, there were other struggles, and this is the, you know, right to march protest as well. Other struggles also include the ongoing struggles of Indigenous people who, as we know, have fought and resisted since colonisation, resisted threats of land and genocide since colonisation. And an important contribution to their struggle was the 1982 Brisbane Commonwealth Games protests, which eventually succeeded in having the 1971 Aborigines Act repealed. The left and unions also won many battles against the Bjelke-Petersen government to save the environment in the 70s and 80s, such as stopping sand mining on Kigari or Fraser Island and the oil drilling on the Great Barrier Reef and the reopening of uranium mines and the protection of North Queensland rainforests. Okay, to sum up, Labor is a bourgeois workers' party and as such is committed to running capitalism. This is why it wouldn't fight Bjelke-Petersen and couldn't be relied on by the various campaigns. Labor governments before Bjelke-Petersen set the scene for his government's repression. The Communist Party also played a conservative role regularly in campaigns because they capitulated to the pressures exerted by the liberal ruling class. They argued that any criticism of these of the liberal element of the ruling class and the liberals were sectarian. The Labor Party and the Communist Party often played an obstructionist role in campaigns, which is why the most successful resistance was the one on the streets. And this brief overview that I've given you shows that even in periods of repressive conservative government, resistance can have some wins. So there are a couple of important lessons for us arising from this discussion, I think. The first, it's important to fight and resist any issue that arises, be that attacks on workers' rights, abortion rights, homophobia and transphobia, climate change, refugees, or any attempts to curb our democratic rights. Even if we don't win straight away, it shifts the boundaries and community perceptions. And as the expression goes, if you don't fight, you won't win anything. The far left grew in this period because they made the best of the political situations and looked for opportunities to resist. The second lesson, resistance is important and I'd argue necessary to transform the world we live in. It's important to throw yourself into struggle, but to ensure a world where we can all live with dignity and humanity, in other words, where profit and exploitation don't dominate our lives, we need a radical transformation, a revolution. We need to resist and struggle around clear revolutionary politics, because revolutions don't magically happen just because we want them to. It makes sense that the more radicals and militants with revolutionary politics there are, the bigger and more effective our impact will be. Lenin said it's important for revolutionaries to be the tribune of the people, to respond and fight against any issue or injustice that arises. And the more people that we can convince to join the fight, the more effective we can be. That means getting involved now and not waiting until we're under attack. So if you've been inspired by today's conference, the whole of today, and this talk, come and talk to someone from Socialist Alternative, the group that's hosted this conference. Thank you.